Hello, welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is going phenomenally.
So we have the big news of the week is, of course, Tommy Tuberville resigned on Sunday. Stepped down as Cincinnati's head coach. The coaching search has begun anew. But first, what were your thoughts on Tuberville actually stepping down from the job? Did you think it would happen so soon, or did you think they would wait until, I guess, tomorrow, the 7th, to make any kind of coaching move?
I thought they would wait, just strictly for the money savings, but I'll bet, you know, they made a deal. They probably still had to pay a little bit more out of pocket than they would have if they would have waited, but they couldn't just kind of sit on him for a week before they even start their coaching search in earnest. They had to happen Sunday. So, all things considered, I'm happy to see Tubbs go, and we'll see what coach we bring in here.
Yeah, the end of the year banquet was on Saturday, so if there was any good time for him to resign, like right after saying goodbye to the players and packing up his belongings and moving on, that seemed like a good enough time to put like a bow on the end of the football season.
Yeah, and that banquet's become quite an interesting place over the years. There's been some, how do I phrase this? Controversial moves, moments at that banquet over the years. You know, you got Brian Kelly coming up the escalator with Stadies at his side. That was a good look. Bush Jones pulled some questionable moves behind the scenes that I don't really want to talk about when he had his banquet before he left for Tennessee.
Well, now you have to talk about it.
No. Because the problem is I've only heard this from one person, so I can't really. Unless I have confirmation. I'm not an actual reporter, but I still don't feel comfortable just wildly speculating on rumors.
That's an off-the-air conversation.
Yes. But only if you don't tell anybody.
Well, we had John Goebel, Chris and I did on the podcast a while ago. I think about last season. He said on the way to the banquet was when the Brian Kelly leaving for Notre Dame stuff happened. So that had to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, not so much. And what I'll remember from that more than anything else is the way that Marty handled himself in front of, like, he became the de facto spokesperson for the program and the athletic department after that. And he handled himself incredibly well.
A good guy. It's just a bit disappointing that things didn't really work out with him in the pros, but seems like he's had a nice career doing whatever he's doing.
Yeah, and he's always Marty. He's always welcome.
Definitely. So, let's jump in the coaching carousel. Been a lot of different names bandied about for Cincinnati. The big one right now seems to be, like, Charlie Strong seems to be a hot name. PJ Fleck of Western Michigan seems to be a pretty hot name. And now with the news coming out that he's not really a candidate at Oregon, seems like things are, like, gonna start heating up with PJ Fleck. It seems like he's their, I would guess, their top target. Then Strong. If that would just be my guess.
Yeah, he has to be the top target because it's basically public information at this point that he would have listened to Oregon, and, you know, he would have interviewed with them. They didn't give him the chance to, but he's made it pretty clear that he would prefer to stay in the Midwest. And I don't know if that's the reason why he was precluded from interviewing with the Ducks, but if it is, it's all to UC's benefit because the only other job that was open in the Midwest was Purdue. As we talked about on last week's pod, Purdue is, they're in a better conference situation. Their program is not in better shape than UC's is. Over the last decade, there's really no question which program has been at a higher level. So now that that job is filled with Brom, who was also one of the three guys on the shortlist for UC, it's opening up the possibility of Fleck to UC, which I am all for because I think PJ Fleck is, an incredible coach. Western Michigan was a moribund program for not just like the last couple of years, but for a very long time, and he completely changed the atmosphere around there and made them into a incredibly solid, program over the last 2-3 years. He was recruited at an extremely high level for the MAC. He has been Western ties. His energy is something that UC needs desperately after, the malaise of the Tuberville era, and his ability to turn that program around speaks a lot to his organizational capabilities, and that's something that he's really going to need at UC. So I think like that is a home run hit if they can get it. We'll see.
It'd be a pretty big step up if they could get PJ Fleck. Like, I know like the big concern with him would be like, would he just leave for the next big job that came along? But I kind of think that's something you just can't worry about. You just have to get the best coach that you can and then hope for the best.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's just like, it's just like running a business. If you're afraid to hire the best candidate because you're afraid that the best candidate will leave after a year, then you're not running your business correctly. The only way you can succeed in an organization as big as a football program or even an athletic department is to hire the best people and let them do their jobs. You can't, you cross that bridge when you cross it. You can't shy away from making that hire because you think, oh, this is a rising star, he's not going to be here for long. That's, if you're thinking in those terms, your approach to the problem is not correct.
Because it seemed like that was part of the move for Tuberville, was they wanted somebody who was going to stay for a while, and he stayed 4 years. So that didn't really turn out any better than hiring a Brian Kelly or Butch Jones or Mark D'Antonio, where they just leave after 3 years. You didn't really get what you wanted from a guy who seemed like he would stay for a long time. There's really like no right way to go about getting a coach. You just have to go out and hustle. And with Indiana open, I think that is maybe competition if they were going to go after Fleck as well.
Yeah, but you're still going to have to deal with a fundamental problem with Indiana, which is, to the people who run that university, Indiana football just doesn't matter. They paid Kevin Wilson pretty well, but they never really gave him the amount of resources he needed to succeed, even in the lesser of the Big Ten divisions. That's really the issue with Indiana and all these other Big Ten universities in the West that aren't Wisconsin or Iowa or Nebraska, schools that are willing to throw tens of millions of dollars after the problem of fielding a competitive football team. They have real institutional limitations, and that's, if the question is how high do you want to fly? I mean, yeah, if you can turn Indiana into a 10-win team, you're a miracle worker and you can have your pick of jobs. But what are the odds of you actually turning Indiana into a 10-win team? Like, I don't think that's happened in 70 years.
That's a good point, but it's not like Indiana's been like as mortar-bound as Purdue has been lately. They've been making some bowl games. It's very hard to win in the Big Ten. But if like they're willing to spend as much as Purdue did to get Brom, like, do you think that would offer a challenge that maybe getting somebody like Fleck, if you just have to compete like that money-wise?
Yeah, but that's the fundamental question is, are they willing to throw that amount of money at a new hire? Because historically, Indiana has the same reputation that Purdue has in terms of their hiring practices, where they will find the best available candidate for the right price, and they won't go above that price. To get Fleck, they will have to go above their usual, their usual pay grade. Are they going to be willing to do that again after the Kevin Wilson debacle. Maybe? Maybe not? Because that's the other thing that you have to consider with Indiana and their willingness to pay for this stuff is, to a lot of people in that department, yeah, they paid, they shelled out for a new football coach, they shelled out for a good football coach, and then he brought disgrace upon the university. Do they want to do that again? There are people in Indiana asking that question. That's not exactly an environment conducive to immediate success.
It sounds like the problems that got him dismissed from that Indiana job were concerns when they hired him, which makes that whole situation even weirder. But we can move on from Indiana and focus on Cincinnati. Some of the other candidates kicked around. Neil Brown has been a pretty hot name. He's the coach at Troy. I believe he was a coordinator at Kentucky for a couple of years. The coach at Appalachian State, Satterfield, has been a candidate mentioned. And there's been a couple like off-the-radar names. What would you be comfortable? Would you be comfortable if UC went out and hired like a coordinator to be their coach? Or would you expect more of like a name brand coach? Like Tony Gibson is one name that Bruce Feldman kicked around, West Virginia's defensive coordinator.
It really depends on how the candidates at the top of the list go. So Brown's off the list. Fleck is still there. Charlie Strong is still available. If those two don't work out, then I'm open to anything. But I think those two are the top candidates for obvious reasons. I would prefer Fleck to Strong, personally, because I think just his brand of football better suits the talent that's on the roster, and B, his personality is something that is desperately needed at UC, because they need somebody who's willing to sell the program again. Tubbs didn't really do that. Butch Jones didn't really do that. You know, that was a Brian Kelly thing, and he did it exceptionally well. And they need that again, especially in this era where there is no imminent expansion on the horizon. You see, you're stuck in the Power Five for the foreseeable future. They need to position themselves as the top of that group below the Power Five schools. There's like 5 or 10 of them. They need to be in that group, and they need to hire and act accordingly. Going after Fleck, going after Strong, that signals sends that signal. Now, if for whatever reason they don't end up hiring either of those two guys, you have to go for the best available candidate. It's like a draft. You have to get the best guy who fits your program. I think Neil Brown of the mentioned second-tier candidates would be the best, but I really like Satterfield at App State for what it's worth.
I think Satterfield would be pretty interesting. Although, I wouldn't be opposed to Neil Brown. Like, Troy had a pretty solid season before, I guess, kind of falling apart at the end. But, like, Satterfield definitely interests me, because if you can, like, win and be successful at a place like Appalachian State, I think you could carry some of that over to Cincinnati. But it sounds like, I think the most encouraging thing about this coaching search, as opposed to the last one, is like, it sounds like you're definitely going to get, well, not definitely, but it sounds like you're really in the running for one of your top three choices, even with one of them off the board. It sounds like there's a better than 50% chance you get Fleck or Strong. And it'd be kind of an upset if they didn't land one of them.
Yeah, and this is, you know, unlike what Whit Babcock did in bringing Tuberville here, like, this is an actual coaching search. Like, they're interviewing people. They are going out there and looking and finding the right candidate. And that's obviously encouraging. I mean, if you get, I mean, obviously Fleck and Strong are the top two candidates for pretty easy to understand reasons. But even if, like, Satterfield is a phenomenal coach, like, he really is. App State, 5 years ago, was still in the FCS. They transitioned over, and this year they won 9 games. Last year they won 9 games as well. They are just, he's got that program humming, and he's recruiting at a high FBS level. recruiting people to Boone, North Carolina. I don't think people understand how hard that is to do. Because Boone's in the middle of nowhere. Like, the nearest airport's 3 hours away.
And that's not exactly a big, it's just like a big, like, destination job. And that place is, like, seemed to always win. They made another bowl game this season. I think he's a sneaky off-the-radar candidate. Maybe not so much off-the-radar, but I think he's a pretty good candidate.
Yeah, he absolutely is. And, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, even if Fleck and Strong don't come here, they can still find a quality coach. And that's very reassuring. Because they need to right this ship, and they need to do it right away.
And I think this is one of those things where if you just look at, like, any of the coaches, they all bring their own upside. Like, obviously, Fleck is, like, a rising star coach. And even if he pulled a Tom Herman and stayed at Cincinnati 1 or 2 years, you think he would leave the program, like, better than when he left it. And with Strong, we've seen him have success and pull in, like, have very highly ranked recruiting classes at Texas and solid recruiting classes at Louisville. And I believe one of the things he did at Louisville was recruit Cincinnati and take some of the best players out of the city down to Louisville. So if he could recruit them in Cincinnati, which seems to be something that we've talked about a lot and people are starting to complain about now, like, that could be something that helped the program if, like, they could put, like, a lock on Cincinnati recruits.
Yeah, and, like, let's be real. Strong was not fired because he was not a good football coach. He was fired because a couple boosters of Texas did not want him in the first place and never really warmed to him. That's why he lost his job. You know, he had one of the youngest teams in football this year. They had some high moments and they had some really low moments, but that's what young football teams do. They play up and down. They're going to be much better next year, not just because Tom Herman is there, but because they were going to be better next year anyways, because they have so many young players. He was the scapegoat for a lot of people, and he's a better coach than he gets credit for. He just walked into a impossibly difficult situation at Texas where, you know, we talk about the malaise of the Tuberville era. The end of the Mack Brown era was as malaise-y as it gets. Like, there was no animating feature to that program at that time. You know, everything was just kind of slipping and sliding down where you don't want it to be. And he kind of turned it around. You know, he didn't turn it around fast enough or with enough results for a subset of boosters involved with that program. But that doesn't mean he didn't do a good job. He just got scapegoated for things that were really beyond his control.
And, like, losing to Kansas didn't really help.
No, that did not help.
The talent level at Texas was really low for a program like Texas when he got there. And it took him, 3 years to find a quarterback. Which should help. At least, like, they have Hayden Moore and Trail at Cincinnati, if you were to take over.
Yeah, I mean, UC's roster is in a good spot for whoever takes it, because the defense is going to be very good. They're losing a couple of key contributors in Mike Tyson, Zach Edwards, Eric Wilson. Those are, you know, very, very good players who will be dearly missed, but there's a lot of talent still on this roster.
I think, like, Tuberville did a decent job building up the roster. And it seemed like the biggest part was getting everything into place. And with him gone and probably all the assistants gone, you got to think whoever comes in is going to bring in their own assistants, especially if it's, like, Strong or Fleck. So we should see some interesting things next season. Let's talk about the AAC as a whole, since it seems like a lot has changed since we last talked. I think the most surprising thing is Matt Rhule, like, up and left for Baylor. Temple could be in a pretty interesting spot next season, because it's like, what kind of coach do they get? It seems like they would be somebody who would should really try to get like a Satterfield type. I don't know. That's going to be an interesting job search for Temple.
Yeah, that's Temple is a harder job than people give it credit for, because they have had sustained success in recent years, but that is extremely abnormal. That's not what Temple is usually, you know, usually about. Remember, this is a team that got kicked out of the Big East once for essentially failure to perform. And they didn't get better for a very long time. You know, Al Golden started it. Matt Rhule continued it. Who do they get to? Oh, and Adazio. I forgot about Adazio. Everybody forgets about Adazio. It's really going to be interesting to see who they go after, because Temple has succeeded playing a particular brand of football, and let's just say that the pool of candidates who are going to adhere to that particular brand of football is exceedingly small. Not many people play the way that Temple has for the last couple of years. If they want to continue, you know, having that general feel to it, their offense and how they attack teams, it's going to be tough to find someone who meets those criteria and has, you know, experience recruiting in the Northeast and, you know, has ties to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and the Tidewater area of Virginia, where they've recruited a lot in the last couple of years. I mean, it's just a tough, tough gig to have the kind of success that Rhule has had.
Yeah, that's going to be a pretty interesting coaching search. They say that they're going to have a full open search for their next coach, not just promote from within, which it seems like that's going to be an interesting thing for Temple. Because the other big coaching search, Houston, has seemed like they have four candidates, or at least four people they interviewed, Lane Kiffin, Les Miles, and their coordinators, Major Applewhite and Todd Orlando. It seems like South Florida is going to become open since Willie Taggart's a really hot name. So like, if Cincinnati can make a good hire with their coach, it seems like they can be right at the top of the list to compete, at least for the East Division title, for sure.
Yeah. UC has a level of resources and a just kind of roster stability that a lot of teams in the East don't have. So if they make the right hire, they can shoot right to the top of the AAC East and compete for the conference title again. And that's really honestly where UC should be every year after year, with the level of resources they have, the recruiting base they have, and the success that they've had in the last 15 years. I mean, that's the standard, and Tubbs didn't meet it. That's why he got fired. But whoever takes this job is going to be in good shape to kind of continue in that vein, because, you know, this was a young team still. And they're going to be better next year regardless of who the coach is. They just need to find somebody who is capable of coming in and maximizing their talent.
Yeah, that seems like the major issue is maximizing your talent. And I'm pretty confident UC is going to find somebody who's going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. Tubbs set a very low bar with this roster.
You mean that the four wins wasn't good enough?
Yeah, I mean, like, just a chimpanzee throwing darts at a board, you know, calling plays would have done just as well, I think. Or, like, you could just roll the football onto the ground and just say, hey, guys, go play. That's fine. They would have won four games.
Before we move on, can we talk about, like, how crappy the AAC bowl games ended up being this year?
Oh, no. We need to talk about how insane it is that people in 2016 think Kerry Combs should be a head coach anywhere, let alone at UC. We need to talk about that first.
Okay, yes, let's talk about that. So I did see, like, his name as soon as Tupperville stepped down, like, Kerry Combs' name started popping up. And, like, everybody likes Kerry Combs, but, yeah, that just seems insane.
Yeah, did you read the Doc article?
Oh, of course not.
Yeah, I shouldn't have, but I did. Like, this is the problem, is that Cincinnati people think that the only people who can succeed in Cincinnati are Cincinnati people. That is false. Like, that is so false. It's stupid. Kerry Combs has been a head coach. He's been a college coach for 10 years. He has been at Ohio State for 5 years. Not once has a MAC program even interviewed him to be a head coach. Not once. He hasn't even gotten to the interview phase. But we have reputable people in this city saying, oh yeah, the Kerry Combs would be a slam dunk hire. In what fucking universe? He has never done anything as a college coach. Like, he failed upwards once. Like, he sucked at UC. When Steve Stripling got the defensive coordinator gig over him, he threw a fit and went to OSU. Since he's been at OSU, he's been demoted like 4 times. He is said to be a ace recruiter, but he doesn't recruit Cincinnati very well for OSU. And that's with nearly unlimited power and unlimited resources and the biggest brand in this area. And he still can't pull kids from Cincinnati for OSU. But because of his ties to the Queen City, he's going to be a phenomenal coach for UC. Like, what are you talking about? There is no basis in fact for the suggestion that Kerry Combs is even competent as a college coach. And not as a head coach. I'm like college assistant.
It's not like he's their defensive coordinator or like one of their like up and coming coaches. Like he's one of their assistants in some lower level.
He is in charge of special teams, which he's not really in charge of special teams. Urban Meyer coaches all his special teams and has from day one. Like that's his thing. But he has the title of special teams coordinator and associate head coach, which means he's basically in charge of, you know, firing up the troops, blah, 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 blah. He doesn't have an actual job. He has no, like, Urban Meyer carved out a role in his program so that he could keep him around for recruiting purposes. But, like, he doesn't do on-field coaching. Like, they've long since hired people to do the things that he was originally hired to do. Like, he is just so not the right answer for UC. And anybody who thinks he is living in a dream world.
Yeah,
rant like, over.
That's, like, one of those things, like, you see people say his name. It's like, oh, okay. You're one of those people. Like, he's, like, a likable guy. And, like, he's memorably passionate, but like that, I don't think that means that he's the guy you should go out and hire to be your head coach.
Especially, yeah, you know who else? You know who else is passionate? PJ fucking Fleck. Pretty passionate, and he's good. And so he also has a step above Coombs.
And he's also got a catchphrase: the row the boat,
row the damn boat.
Who wouldn't want to row the boat?
Commies, that's who. No, if you think about it, row the boat as a catchphrase is pretty socialist.
Maybe that's a strike against PJ. Maybe that's why he didn't get interviewed at Oregon.
Yeah, nobody rows a boat alone.
Yeah, with that out of the way, I just want to complain about the AAC bowl games for a minute.
Because yeah, they're hot garbage.
Yeah, they're even worse than you would imagine. Because you have Houston playing San Diego State, and that's on the first day of bowl season for one. And that's about the most notable opponent an AAC team plays is San Diego State. Like, Central Florida plays Arkansas State, a game that's not even on ESPN, which is how low a bowl game it is. Tulsa plays Central Michigan at 2:30 on a Monday. Memphis plays in the Boca Raton Bowl against Western Kentucky, where their coach is already gone. Navy plays Louisiana Tech, which, of course, Navy was already sealed into that game anyway. But apparently, Navy could have caused all sorts of hell if they won last week, because they would could have ended up in the Access Bowl, which would have really made all these other smaller bowls really have to scramble to fill their spots. Which would have been kind of fun, and they
played. Yeah, ESPN had 4 hours of programming on Sunday releasing the bowls. If Navy would have won, they would basically have had 4 hours of people just going yada yada yada, because they couldn't decide anything.
I kind of wish they won. Even though
it would have been phenomenal.
Even though I did predict Temple would win, and I feel like a genius. Speaking of Temple, like, their reward for winning the league is a December 27th bowl against Wake Forest, which is awesome. And South Florida, probably the second pick, or you would assume, since Navy was already locked into their bowl game. They play South Carolina in the Birmingham Bowl, the Pitt Special. Like, that's your bowl games for the AAC. A really terrible slate of games that seems even worse than last year.
Yeah, so South Florida's reward is losing Willie Taggart and playing a high school quarterback in a bowl game.
In Birmingham.
Yeah, I'm not sure that most people know that, but yeah, South Carolina has a quarterback who should be in high school. Like, now. Like, he skipped his senior year.
And he was actually pretty good, which is...
Yeah, because he was very good for a high school senior. Yeah, playing in the SEC. That was phenomenal.
To get your team to a bowl game, that's a pretty decent job. Although he wasn't great against Temple, and he only threw for 1,000 yards, which is also not great.
In his defense, he does have big, dumb Will Muschamp football as his head coach. So 1,000 yards in that scenario is like 2,000 yards for anybody else.
A fair point. Keep on top of things. No coaching news or rumors for Cincinnati as we've been recording this. So let's move on to basketball. Bearcats had a 2-0 week, winning an ugly but ultimately satisfying game against Iowa State before just blowing the doors off of Bowling Green. The Iowa State game, like, UC would have lost that game last year because long shot at the end would have gone in. And this year it rimmed out, and UC wins 55-54 in overtime. Then Kai Washington goes, like, batshit crazy against Bowling Green, scoring 24 points in 23 minutes. And putting a capper on a week that ended with him being the AAC Player of the Week. So, it's like, how do you unbox the last week of basketball?
Okay, so I'm happy with the win, obviously. I am thrilled with the play of Kyle Washington. I'm thrilled with the play of Jacob Evans. I am not thrilled with the general coaching of Mick, still. Like, I don't think he's using guys the right way. Like, Justin Jennifer is a perfect example of that. He played, 7 minutes in the Iowa State game in a game that was crying out for someone to create anything, for a little bit of offensive spark for the Bearcats. If they played a little bit better offense against that team, they probably win by 10. But, like, he just seems to have a conditional relationship to what offensive production is and when he needs. Just because you can win a game 55-50 against a good team doesn't mean that you should play for a 55-50 game. Especially when you have talent that is capable of more than this. You know, UC is still floating in the top 40 for offensive efficiency, which is by miles the highest in the Mick Cronin era here at UC. And the offense still should be better. Like, way better.
Yeah, that was my biggest takeaway from the week, is how much Mick just doesn't trust the bench. Like, you were being generous with Justin Jennifer's minutes. He played 5 minutes in the Iowa State game. Like, I know that's a game, like, you really don't want to take Troy out too much, but you have, like, other spots to take guys out. Like, why are you playing Kevin Johnson 40 minutes? I don't really understand that part. And especially on a day where UC was unbelievably terrible shooting the deep ball. Jennifer's, like, their best three-point shooter now. And I don't even think he attempted a three in that game, which was kind of terrible.
Yeah, and...
the bench scored 2 points in the Iowa State game. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's known as not good in these circles. That's the biggest problem, is that he has such an aversion to what Justin Jennifer kind of brings to the team that I don't even know why the hell he recruited Justin Jennifer in the first place. It's like, Justin Jennifer has a specific skill set. He is going to get into the teeth of the defense, break it down, and create chaos. Like, that is what he does. That is his number one overall trait. That's what he does better than anything else. You know, because of his size, he's not going to be a good finisher at the rim. Because of his height, it's going to be tough for him to get a shot off against longer defenders. Like, there are weaknesses in his game that I'm sure he would point out himself. But there are times when this team cries out for his skill set, and Mick just doesn't trust him. And I don't understand it. Like, Kevin Johnson played how many minutes in the Iowa State game? Like 30?
39 minutes. He played pretty much 40 minutes. He played the entire game.
There is not a game. Like, Kevin Johnson should never play that many minutes. He had a good game against Iowa State, don't get me wrong. But he is not a player who is better with a large sample size. The less he plays, the more effective he is. Because of all the players on the team, he has the most offensive weaknesses. He seemingly has no confidence in his shot. He will never take a catch-and-shoot shot, ever. He always has to take a pump fake. He always has to take a dribble. He's not willing to just catch and shoot. That's not something that he can do. I don't know if it's like that's his version of the yips. Like, that's a hang-up that he has mentally, that he has to, you know, get that dribble or that pump fake in. But it makes him unplayable because everybody knows it's coming. So when everybody knows you're going to pump fake, doing a pump fake isn't going to do anything. They're just going to sit there and wait. And then there's still going to be a hand in your face when you're taking your shot. You know, that was the best game that Kevin Johnson played. And it still wasn't that good because he played so many minutes and he had probably 3 or 4 turnovers, if my memory serves me correctly. Like, that's – Justin Jennifer should play more. This team needs 2 ball handlers. They need 2 creators. And more to the point, there's a clear difference between the offense with Justin Jennifer and Troy Copain. With Jennifer, the ball moves. When Troy's out there, it doesn't. And that's kind of a problem because they have 5 guys who can pass. Especially, like, if you go Jennifer, Copain, Jacob Evans, Kyle, and Gary, like, that's 5 guys who are willing and able passers. And you should take advantage of that. But too much of the offense still revolves around Troy Copain just pounding the ball at the nail. And that's not good offense. And that's not what this team should be based on. The foundational piece of this offense should be the interior passing of Gary Clark and Kyle Washington. Those guys were phenomenal against Iowa State. They got into the teeth of the defense. They made plays for each other all night long, and it was just too easy. Like, that's the foundation of the offense, Mick. That's what you should be working towards. Getting Gary or Kyle at the nail with the ball and letting them make plays. That's far more efficient than just having Troy endlessly pound the ball waiting for a pick and roll.
The game-tying shot in regulation was Clark from the elbow. Which is a pretty good shot since they got it. Like, even at the end of the game, like, when Copain passed to Evans, just remember, like, Evans was surprised he got the ball. Which is probably not a great sign.
Yeah, your best player should never be surprised when they get the ball. Like, if their eyes widen, like, oh my god, shit. That means something's wrong with your offense, Mick.
I think you could really make a case, like, at least this early part of the season, their best player's definitely been Washington.
Yeah. I mean, he's been much better than I thought he would be.
He's been one, like, I think he's been one of the best players in the country.
KenPom has him 8th in his Player of the Year rankings. Which I can't remember seeing a UC player that high at this point in the season. SK got there at the end of his senior season, but he wasn't there to start.
No, not at all. And like, Washington just brings so much, like, such a big boost to this team. Like, one of the things, like, we did worry about in the offseason was, like, who takes, like, the Ellis role as, like, the leader on the court, and it's definitely been Washington. And he's even played better than Ellis has, or did, in the past. Maybe outside of Ellis' first season back at Cincinnati. Like, offensively, he's the best big guy they've had in...
ever.
Yeah. You have to start rolling
in the big
back
era,
to the
it's ever.
Era. Yeah. Then you have to start rolling back to, like, the Hicks Max Seal days.
Yeah, you got to go back to Max. I mean, like, but that's what's so frustrating is they have all these pieces and they fit together kind of well. Even, like, we talked about the clunky fit of Gary and Kyle. Over the last 3 or 4 games, they've kind of figured that out a little bit. It's still not perfect. It's still a little sloppy at times. But it's miles better than it was in the first couple games of the year. So, like, even, like, that was the biggest hang-up with the offense before. And now the biggest hang-up with the offense? Troy's been, like, pretty shitty. Honestly. Like, his offensive rating right now is 104, which would be the lowest of his career. Like, he's just not playing well. He's not shooting well. He's turning the ball over at a higher clip than usual. And he's not... It's... Like, he's become a ball stopper. And that was, like, he can do that when we don't really have other offensive players. That's fine. Like, we got guys who can score, who can do things with the ball, so you can't have it for 20 seconds of every possession, Troy. You need to move it on.
His assist rate's way down from last season. He assisted on 29% of UC's baskets while he's on the court. Now he's down to 22%. It's like a pretty dramatic drop-off from your starting point guard. And against, like, the good teams they've played, at least the Rhode Island and Iowa State, his assist rate's under 17%, and his turnover rate's nearly 19%. Like, he's, like, I don't know if he's putting too much pressure on himself this year to be, like, an All-American, or, like, live up to the preseason Player of the Year hype, but, like, his shot is still broken. Like, he had a decent game against Bowling Green, but he still missed all his threes. He's 7 of 32 for the season. And, like, the biggest problem with the team is seems to be the outside shooting is just so terrible. Like, Kevin Johnson is... Who knows what happened to Kevin Johnson's jump shot? Like, I think a lot of what you said about him just being afraid to pull the trigger is... definitely true, because his usage rate is way down for Kevin Johnson. And, like, if you remember his early days, you'd be the guy who was like, why is Kevin Johnson shooting so much? And now it's like, why isn't Kevin Johnson actually shooting when he's got an open shot?
Well, that's the funniest thing. Like, his effectiveness generally hasn't changed, but he plays more minutes, and that's the problem.
And it's... Because, like, on the, it's like sophomore season, the year he started playing more, he would be, like, the guy off the bench who, like, would just come in, like, shoot threes when nobody else would shoot. And he had a...
Yeah, he didn't have a conscience. He would launch. He didn't care.
That conference play in 2015 season, he hit 38%. And he hasn't been close to that in any category since. Which, I don't know how you get him back to that point where he's just pulling the trigger at will, but yeah, something is just messed up with his shot and Copain's shot. And when, like, those are your two guards that you play the most, like, you have one 3-point option on the court pretty much the whole time. And if Evans isn't scoring, like, he had a pretty bad week. just by his standards, where he scored 18 combined points. But if he's not getting anything from deep, you're kind of just, like, fucked. Like they were against Iowa State when they missed a million threes.
Well, that's the problem with, like, someone needs to tell Troy and KJ, like, someone, like, I think they're roommates, someone should just give their house a call and be like, hey, you know what the Hippocratic Oath is? Do you? First, do no harm. So, like, that should be how they play. First, don't fuck anything up for everybody else. Because if they don't make the kind of boneheaded, stupid decisions they've been making over the last 2 weeks, this offense will be fine. Like, those two have been the biggest problem with the offense over the last 2 weeks, is that they just, they played a certain way for so many years that they are unwilling to kind of change tack. But for this team to get where they need to be, or can be, if they want to go to the Final Four, if they want to put that on their resume, they have to change how they play. Like, they can't keep dominating the ball the way they do. Like, they need to start realizing that this team, like, last year, the saying was, this team will go as far as Troy goes, and that was right. This year, it's not. Like, this team will go much further if they just kind of step aside a little bit and let Jacob Evans and Gary and Kyle Washington have more of a say in how the offense is run and how it flows. Because those guys are playing at a much higher level than they are right now. But their insistence on dominating the ball the way they have is preventing that from coming to fruition. And that's really the biggest problem right now. Like, and this is totally a first world problem. You see, is 8-1. Even if they go, I'm sorry, 7-1. Even if they lose to Butler, they're at 7-2 and probably still pretty comfortably in the top 25. But they're in good shape. These are little problems, but they're still problems. Because these are the kind of things that you can sustain over the course of a season, especially playing in a conference like the AAC, where not everybody is going to give you a challenge. But when you get to the tournament, like, the unwillingness of your two starting guards to pass the ball to anybody is kind of a problem. Like, these are problems that show up in tournament times because you're playing better competition. And you need to solve them now when you're not. But there doesn't seem to be any urgency or willingness to address them as problems.
Yeah, which is, yeah, like you mentioned, it's like kind of a first world concern, but it's still a major problem. Like, playing a team like Butler, or even like going on the road to Temple, we've seen knock off some quality teams. Like, you should be able to, like, just pretty much skate through the league with only a couple of losses. But, like, you have the big Xavier game at the end of January. Like, you're going to get some challenges from some good teams. And like, depending on, like, how you, like, show up in some of these games, I do worry about, like, the guard play a little bit, which I don't think we gave much credence to at the beginning of the season, since, like, their starting lineup just looks so good. And it's been three.
Yeah, but nobody anticipated Troy playing this badly.
That's to be true.
I mean, we predicted Kevin Johnson being Kevin Johnson. Like, that wasn't a surprise. And as much as I hate to admit it, you guys were completely right in Mick's unwillingness to address the problem of Kevin Johnson. Like, Justin Jennifer should be starting over Kevin Johnson. Like, that should be your starting five.
Even if he's not starting, he should be playing half his minutes.
Yes. Like, Kevin Johnson was playing 75% of the minutes of the shooting guard. That is unacceptable. A, he's not really a shooting guard because he's unwilling or unable to shoot. And B, like, his defense, however good it might be, it doesn't make up for the fact of how bad he has been on offense. Like, he had a good game against Iowa State. I'm not going to take that away from him. But he's a senior. We have a huge body of evidence that suggests that was a one-game outlier. If he can do that, play at that level for a month, then I'll listen. Then I'll stop bashing him. But I have very good evidence to suggest that this was a one-game blip, and he's not going to continue to play this well, and that his confidence will evaporate, and he will become a ball stopper like he's been for the last 3 years. And that's not what UC needs.
And the bench is, like you mentioned, Jennifer, like, if his play is going to be, like, yo, his minutes, not his play, if his minutes are going to be yo-yoed around, it's going to make it harder for him to be as consistent as you would want him to be. And from what we've seen from the bench mob, like, there are no scorers on the bench. Like, Trey Scott's not going to do anything. Brooks isn't going to do anything. Cumberland just doesn't seem like he's going to get minutes against anybody like he was above average. It's like, I think, like, you're looking at a situation where you need your starting lineup to score a ton of points. And, like, when they don't, you can get by because your defense is still so good. Like, they have a top 10 defensive efficiency, in large part to that Iowa State game. And even the Bowling Green game, they only give up 56 points. But, again, it's like we've seen against Rhode Island, like, you can't just rely on your starters to do everything.
And that's the thing. Like, I have a feeling of this team that is very similar to how I felt about the SK senior team. It's like, they're good. No doubting that. They are very good. But there are obvious holes in this team that need to be addressed. And there is an unwillingness from Mick or an inability of the players that he has to address that. Like, I think it's more A than B. Like, I just think that at this point, Mick is so stubborn and is so determined to prove that he can win at a high level playing this caveman basketball that he loves. And, like, he's just not going to deviate from it, even if everybody would benefit from a change in tack. So, yeah, they'll probably win the AAC or compete very closely. They'll probably get into the tournament again. And then when they play a real team that, you know, can attack them in multiple ways, they'll just kind of evaporate. It's like, I still remember the feeling of watching that first 5 minutes of the Harvard game and the sinking realization that, oh, shit, this team has answers for the one thing we do. And if they have an answer for that, Mick doesn't seem to have the ability or the willingness to change what he does. And that puts a definite ceiling on how far you can go in the tournament. Like, we've been talking for years about how the best teams are able to play multiple ways. And that's what the regular season is for, is finding out if guys can do certain things in different situations. Like he needs to treat the regular season as a lab. It's like, let's see what Trey Scott can do. Like, he's not, he's obviously not a scorer. He's not going to be an incredibly proficient player on offense for the next couple of years. And that's fine. But you know what I like about Trey Scott? He is always in the right spot at the right time. And just standing in the right spot at the right time is a skill in basketball. You can get 4 or 5 points pretty cheaply from just standing in the right spot at the right time. So let's see if he can do that against better teams. But against better teams, they don't even give them minutes. So how do you learn anything?
Even just like being in position to get offensive rebounds and keep possessions alive is a pretty huge skill that you've won from some of your big men like Trey Scott. It's like, yeah, it's like the Iowa State game, I think, is just a barometer for what we're going to see. And like, I think against Butler for sure. Maybe Jennifer will get a couple more minutes. Like, maybe Cumberland gets a little more run if they're losing. But it's like really hard to see like where Mick Cronin trusts the bench. Because like, Quad, he's barely going to play. Jennifer, if he gets more than like 2 segments, it kind of seems like it would be an upset. Like, Scott and Brooks' minutes, they both depend on foul trouble. And Cumberland's got to spell Evans whenever Evans has to take a break. Like, and that's like pretty much your rotation, and I don't really know how far you can get with such a thin rotation where there's no scoring really, or at least no consistent scoring. So we've seen Jennifer and Cumberland go off, but if somebody gets hurt or like you get foul trouble, Like, your whole season could be, like, up in smoke. Especially if, like, there's an injury to Copain, which would be a nightmare scenario for this team, I think.
Yeah, that would be the worst-case scenario. Even as badly as he's playing, you know, he's still so vital to this team.
And even, like, unlike last year, you don't really have, like, somebody like Cobb who could just slide over and play the point. Like, who would you be playing Jennifer a ton of minutes? And then your other point guard would be, what, Kevin Johnson? Or you'd have Evans bring the ball up? I don't know. It brings up a whole different set of problems.
Okay, so if Troy goes down, you give the ball to Evans on every possession and let him make plays. And, like, that's not optimal, but he can do it. His scoring will suffer. His efficiency will probably suffer, but he can be an effective player that way. I mean, like, this is the fundamental question of the Mick era is, how do you get your guys in positions where they can succeed? Because the way they're playing right now, only one guy can really succeed, and that's Troy. Like, this offense right now is built for Troy to succeed, and Troy is not playing well. So how long do you continue to play this one way before you realize that you need to change the direction of the offense and run things through the interior a little bit more than you have previously, or, you know, try to change the pace, run a little bit faster? Give the ball to Justin Jennifer a few more times a game. Let him create shots for other players. Like, there are options. Like, there are solutions to the question. But you have to be willing to, you know, engage them, to give them a shot, especially in the regular season when it's not one and done. But, like, his lack of faith and lack of trust in the guys that he recruited is stark to me. It's like, if you don't like what they do, why did you bring them here?
It's a fair question. Because, like, we've been over this, like, for years, but, like, at some point you have to, like, try to open things up a little bit and let the guys play. And it just seems like that's not going to ever happen with Mick Cronin as the coach. Fair or foul. But, and it does, you do have to wonder how, like, long they're going to just be so, like, clinically efficient. Especially from, like, two, like, Washington's over 61%. Evans is 67% on his two-point shots. Clark is at 62%. Kevin Johnson's at 60%. Like, when you start playing better defenses, those percentages are going to fall. And we've seen them be terrible from three, terrible from the foul line, outside of Evans. And that turnover rate is definitely a big issue. When Copain, Cumberland, and Trey Scott are the only guys who have a better turnover rate than, or assist rate than turnover rate, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, but it's just, like, one day. I want to see one game, just one, where Mick doesn't call a play every single time down the court. Just see what they can do. Like, I'm convinced that if you let this group of players just play, you'll get better outcomes than you do having Mick dictate every single play, every single time down the floor.
And you have, like, a senior point guard, too. It's not like Copain's a freshman. He's a senior. You can't let your senior run the offense. Like, what's the point? What's the point of having a senior point guard?
Yeah, I mean, like, if he doesn't trust Troy, like, who the fuck is he ever going to trust?
So, like, after Butler, you get, like, you get the soft underbelly of the schedule. And if there's any time to let the team run, it's maybe not Fairleigh Dickinson or Texas Southern, but Marshall is one of the fastest teams in the country. And, like, if they don't run up and down with Marshall, it would feel like a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, like,
like, Ohio State hung over 110 points on Marshall.
Yeah. And this team, honestly, like, against some of these teams, they should be hitting 100. Like, they should have hit 100 against Stanford. They should have hit 100 against Lipscomb. They definitely should have against Bowling Green, but they play so fucking slow that 100's a dream. It's like, you have the players to run. You've talked for years about how you want to run and play faster. They changed the shot clock, essentially, for you, so that it's only 30 seconds, and you still play at the slowest pace of fucking anybody. Like, it's maddening. They're 345th in time of possession, in average tempo. There are how many teams playing Division I? Like, 360?
351 on KenPom. But you do have the Wisconsin and St. Mary's, Virginia, all, like, top 10 teams who are down there. That's probably, like, the motivation for it. But then you also have, like, Holy Cross and, like, Mercer, and Mercer and Holy Cross, like, suck.
Yeah, but, like, Virginia plays glacially slow, but Virginia, like, has an offensive, like, they have a coherent offense. Like, it's not one guy pounding the ball for 15 seconds every possession. Like, the ball moves. It might move, like, 10 more times in a possession than it would for any other team, but the ball moves to get good shots. And it doesn't move with UC, and they don't get good shots.
Yeah, that's the biggest difference. Like, offensive efficiency, Virginia is 13th, St. Mary's is 3rd, and Wisconsin is 10th. And Cincinnati's down, like, in the... They're 39th right now.
And we all know that number's going to go down, because as we get to conference play, the pace will slow even more, and the offense will get less efficient. That's just how this goes every year. They'll probably end up in the 60s again.
Because once you stop playing the Samfords and Bowling Greens and Lipscombs, like, your offense obviously gets worse. And teams like Brown are just terrible. It's like, there's the talent on this team. Like, they could be a major threat. And they could make a run. But, like, they're looking at... Like, this Butler game is kind of huge, because it's their last, besides Xavier, this is their second big non-conference game that they kind of have to win. Like, just missing the chance to play Duke and banking that win against Rhode Island was really huge, because now you're looking at an AAC where, like, nobody stands out. Like, SMU is, like, average. UConn's a gigantic disappointment. Houston played LSU and got beat by 20 points. And, like, nobody else in the league has any type of buzz. Like, Memphis started off decently playing nobody, and now they're 6-2. Like, Temple's lost a couple of bad games. Like, you have to get your wins in the non-conference, and, like, unfortunately, they just don't have a ton of chances. And we've seen the AAC teams get really screwed by the committee. And you're looking at another situation where even if you win the league, you might be a 6 or 7 seed at best.
Yeah, I mean, the Butler game is bigger than I thought it would be coming into the season. I thought it would be a pretty big test for them. But it's not just a test. Like, they have to have this. Like, their resume has to have this. So that if they don't win the conference, like, at this point, if they don't win the conference, their resume is paper thin. Like, they have one top 20 win. One top 25 win in the RPI. And that's probably going to be it for the year. Because I don't see any of the teams in the AAC making a run, with the possible exception of SMU. Connecticut has been... Yeah, I don't know what the hell happened to Connecticut, but they're not what we thought they would be.
Yeah, they've already put themselves in such a big hole where... Like, they have gone on a winning streak and put in, like, a couple of nice wins, and they're still 4-4. Like, beating Syracuse doesn't really move the needle for them.
Yeah. I mean, this was a season with so much promise, and it's looking like it's going to be just like every other mixed season. And it doesn't have to be this way. That's the thing. That's the most maddening part of it. It's like, they can be better. They should be better. Why aren't they? But if you ask that question, you're like a pariah among UC fans. Because Mix is saying, and you can't say anything bad about him. It's like, no, like, he's from Cincinnati. Fine. He loves the university. Great. But at a certain point, you got to produce. If you want to talk about lofty goals, and like he has stated that his goal here is to get a national championship for UC. If that's your goal, we're going to hold you to that standard. And what you're doing and what you've been doing for the last 5 years isn't good enough. You have to change what you do. But he's untouchable, and he knows it.
Yeah, it's not like there wasn't a portion of the fan base that wasn't kind of, like, not only to say excited, but, like, they wouldn't have minded so much if he ended up taking the UNLV job last summer instead of just using it as leverage, which he seems like he pretty much did.
Yeah. I mean, he basically, I mean, my take of the UNLV situation is, you know, his brother, in this case, he's the brother. His other brother got a cool new toy. He wants a cool new toy. So to get that cool new toy, he's just going to run away. And he got the cool new toy, so he came back. The cool new toy, in this case, being a new arena. So congrats.
His ploy worked. Worked out pretty well for him. And he got some more money and I think like a bigger recruiting budget, all that other garbage. That doesn't matter to us.
No, but like, you know, if Mick wants that to be the standard, fine. But we're going to judge you on that standard. And what you're doing, what you've done with this team so far, I mean, my God, they should be killing teams. Like, he's never had this much talent on offense, ever. You know, he can put out a lineup with five competent offensive players. Have you ever been able to say that about a Mick team before?
No, definitely not.
And they're only 39th in adjusted efficiency. That's better than they've been, but that's not, like, his highest finish with UC was, like, 59th. And people are, treating that like it's a good thing. Like, no, 59th is still pretty fucking average. Like, you have to be better than that if you want to win a national championship. When was the last time a team with an adjusted efficiency below 60 won a national title?
Oh, God knows. Maybe never.
Villanova 85, maybe? You'd have to really dig, but it's not a long list. Like, you can even broaden that scope to Final Four. So when was the last time with a team with an efficiency below 50 made a Final Four?
It's had to have been a long time.
Like, the way he plays, his margin for error is razor thin. Like, to make a Final Four with this team, not with this team, playing the way that Mick wants to play, you have to get the perfect draw. You have to get four teams who are just absolutely incapable of playing your style because they don't want to get into a rock fight. That doesn't happen in the tournament. The tournament's random. You're going to get four different teams who play four different ways. You can't have just one tool to beat those four teams. Like, you have to be able to play different ways for different teams. And his inability, like, he has not shown one. He's never shown the ability to do that. And that's why I don't think it's ever going to happen with Mick. Unless he changes what he does. And he's so fucking stubborn that he doesn't change anything.
And it's been like the major concern ever since UC turned the corner into a perennial tournament team. It's like, you don't want to look like that gift horse in the face where after UC came back from the dregs, but like, if you want to make the next step, instead of being like, sometimes you make the Sweet 16 or you actually win a game in the first weekend, which has been a struggle lately, like, you have to be well-rounded. Like, it's like Connecticut. I just, like, was looking it up as you were talking. Connecticut, when they won the title, was Shabazz. They were ranked 39th, and they had the worst offensive in 18 that won, like, the title. It's like, if you don't have a top 40 offense, you're kind of screwed. And it's definitely been an issue. It was an issue last season when they lost to St. Joseph's. And it's going to be, like, a bigger issue, like, the more teams that they end up playing, like, who have, like, any kind of above-average defense, which you pretty much only see in March.
Yeah, I mean, Mick, you know, there's a theory of coaching that there are two types of coaches. You have coaches who get you from A to B, and coaches who get you from B to C. A to B for UC was getting back to being a perennial tournament team. And that was hard work, because they basically went 2 years without recruiting. They were in the Big East. Like, what he did getting them from A to B was amazing. Well, now you're firmly at B. You want to get to C. So you have to show that you have that capability. And I have not seen that from Mick in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, like, that's... Is he the B to C coach? I remain unconvinced. You know, the Butler game is not going to convince me one way or the other, but if they finally take the shackles off the offense and just let these guys play, it'll help. But, like, we've had so much history with Mick that we kind of know exactly what he's going to do. Like, as the year goes on, they don't play faster. They play slower. As the year goes on, they don't play better offense. They play worse. The defense doesn't get much better because it's already freaking good. It's like, you can make massive improvements on offense with the way he plays. Like, they're there to be made. But he focuses so much on defense to the detriment of all else.
But you brought it up earlier. I think he's one of those guys who kind of overcoaches the offense too much. That's a major problem in college, but it seems like he's at the top of that list. Where he calls every play. And they don't really have any, like, free-flowing possessions, except if they're in transition.
But they never play fast enough to actually get into transition. Like, you see an outlet pass to the point guard who's ahead of everybody else, and then the point guard literally stops and lets everybody pass him. Every play. That's every rebound for UC. And they have guys who could be incredible in the open court, but they never want to let them play in the open court. Like, Justin Jennifer would be amazing with a faster pace. Justin Jennifer is amazing in transition. Is he ever in transition? No. Same thing for Jacob Evans. Same thing for Gary Clark. Like, you're not maximizing the potential of the talent you have. And that's literally the first item on your job description.
Because we're into year three of Gary Clark, and it seems like, it doesn't seem like, they just haven't found a way to open up his offense. And we've seen him be great running up and down. Like, every single season, like, he's had breakaway dunks and, like, making big plays when UC gets open court opportunities. And, like, you're looking at another year where his usage is way down. He's, like, 17%. His shot percentage is under 16%, which is insane for a player with his talent. And, like, some of it's because Washington is, like, obviously dominating down low. Like, you have to find Gary Clark could be your second best player, like, overall. And, like, he's just kind of there. He's, like, the fourth option on offense. And I don't know. It just seems like he has All-American potential, and he's just not, like, unlocking that door yet.
Yeah, and that's, you know,
and some of it's his personality, too.
Some of it is definitely his personality. He is not aggressive enough, and he would probably be the first person to tell you that in the shyest, meekest voice possible. But at a certain point, like, fine, your player doesn't want to be aggressive. Fine. That's cool. But as a coach, it's your job to maximize the potential. Like, the example of great coaching is Greg Popovich with the Spurs. And he's been with them for so long that we kind of forget the way they used to play. They used to play, like, boring-ass caveman basketball. because they had David Robinson and Tim Duncan. Like, they slowed it way down. They dumped the ball into the post every play. They waited for the double team, and then they kicked out. Like, they played 90s traditional basketball for a very long time because that's what they had the people to do. But over the last 15 years, they've become, like, four different teams playing four different ways because he realized that, okay, to maximize the potential of the offense and the talent that we have to change things this way. Mick doesn't do that. Mick has one system, and he plays one way. He does not have any consideration for what would be the best style of play for Justin Jennifer, for Gary Clark, for Jacob Evans. He has one style, and he tries to jam all these square pegs into a round hole. And that can work when you have only one square peg. But he's got five now. So what's your solution there? It can't be to do the same shit you've been doing forever because it's just not going to work with this talent. You're not going to get the most out of everybody playing this way. Now, when you had a team that had Deontay Vaughn and four other dudes, that was the way to maximize your talent. When you have more talent, that's not the way to do it. But he hasn't made that adjustment. And that's the most frustrating thing because until he makes that adjustment, like, this team has a definite cap on where they can be. You know, until that changes, at this point, like, if you want to, this becomes starker every year we play Xavier because Chris Mack is not a tactical genius by any sense, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. But he does far more to maximize the talent of, like, the diverse talents of his players than Mick ever has. And it's incredibly frustrating because on talent terms, UC is on in most years equal or better. But Matt gets more out of his guys.
Because they can just take like, I blew it. He was probably their best player. Would he be a star in Cincinnati's offense? I don't think so. I don't think he would have broken out the way he did last year. Even like Sumner, I don't think Sumner would have had even remotely close to the same freshman year he had last year. Because Cronin doesn't play that way.
And that's the problem. It's like, his recruiting has gotten much better. His acquiring of talent has gotten leaps and bounds better than it used to be. But that doesn't matter if you don't let the talent speak for itself. Like, at this point, he's actively harming the development of his players. Like, Gary Clark should be so much better. Like, you're absolutely right. Gary Clark has All-American potential. He should be in that category. And he's nowhere near that. Why? It's not him. Like, he's going to play professional basketball for a very long time and make a lot of money doing it. Like, he is a phenomenally talented basketball player. But it's not showing here. And that's the problem.
And I think it's at some point you just run into, like, you have to do something to, like, obviously they've had players break out. Like, Copain had a big breakout a couple years ago. Like, Justin Jackson got better. Kopatrick got better. But it's, like, it got to be up and down the roster. Like, if you only unlock, like, a couple of guys to their maximum potential, you still leave, like, other guys. Like, maybe, like, if they did unlock their potential, they just have to recruit better. Like, that has to be an issue as well. It's like, we've seen Cincinnati's recruiting, like, kind of slip a little bit lately. The AAC as a whole has slipped in recruiting a little bit lately.
Yeah, but that's, and I think there's a reason for that, because going for that caliber of player comes with a certain level of baggage. Because those guys have been stars from the day they were, you know, from 13, 14 years old. They were stars. Everybody told them a star, so they carried themselves like stars. Mick doesn't like stars because then he can't exert his personality over them. So, like, doing that is more difficult. Like, I think the Lance Stephenson experiment was basically the end of him pursuing that level of player because he tried to exert himself over Lance, and it did not work because no one can exert themselves over Lance because Lance is crazy. But a lot of the guys who are in that echelon – they have that attitude. They are hard to handle. You have to have a certain way with players to do that. Mick doesn't want to deal with any of that, so he recruits a lower caliber player because he's not going to have those problems more times than not. You know, more times than not. Now, SK became an All-American, but he was a three-star dude that was completely overlooked. Kerry Clark has All-American talent, but he was a three-star player who was completely overlooked. You know, those are his kind of guys.
You can pretty much go through every great Mick Cronin player and say that. Like Bishop was, I think he was a three-star. And, like, he ended up being a great Cincinnati player. Like, Vaughn wasn't a major recruit. Like, on the other hand, like, you have, like, the guys like Cash and Yancey Gates. I'm just looking at the 2010 roster. Who, like, oh, Cash had injuries, like, derail his career. Like, they were, like, four-star guys. Like, Ibrahim Thomas was a four-star recruit. Like, Darnell Wilkes was a four-star recruit. And, like, those things just didn't work out for them. Like, it seems like there's, I don't know, it's like, Darnell Wilkes is kind of interesting. See, obviously he had talent, and Mick just never knew what to do with Darnell Wilkes. And he, like, barely played ever. But then, like, guys like Deion Dixon, who just go out there and, like, fight every position. Like, for better or worse, end up being, like, Mick's, like, go-to guys. And, like, Kevin Johnson's in that same type of mold. Where Kevin Johnson wasn't a highly, like regarded recruit. I think he was, like, two or three stars. Like, he, like, plays, like, the brands of basketball that Mick Cronin likes, and he's gotten a ton of minutes at Cincinnati.
Yeah, and that's, look, that mentality, that willingness to go after those kind of players, it served him well. I'm not saying it hasn't. Like, he rebuilt the program going after those guys. That's fine, but the program's rebuilt now. You don't need to continue building what's already built. You need to go to the next step. Can you get to that next step and be a consistent top 15 team, making consistent Sweet 16, Final Four runs, recruiting those kind of guys, playing this kind of way? I'm dubious at best.
Yeah, because, like, there's a point where, like, ceiling is, like, a big thing. And if you're playing somebody like, I don't know, like Duke or Kentucky, like, they're just going to throw waves and waves of guys at you. And if you can't match that, like, you're just never going to beat them. Even, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting topic.
And look, Mick is a great example of that topic because, you know, he's gotten to a certain point playing a certain way. And he's firmly entrenched where he is. That's, you know, that's all to the good. But it's a question of what do you want to do? Like, what do you want the ceiling to be? Like, if the ceiling for you is making consistent tournament runs, making the tournament consistently, winning a lot of regular season championships, making the occasional run into the second weekend of the tournament, Nick can probably do that. If you want to win in a big way, in a consistent level, year after year, I'm not sure you can do it building and maintaining the program the way he's doing it. And he'll tell you that the reason that he doesn't go after those guys is, you know, the top tier talent is that he doesn't have the recruiting budget to match. Nah, maybe. Yeah, that could be the case. Gonzaga doesn't have the recruiting budget to match Kentucky or UCLA or any of the other elite blue bloods. But they're a consistent top 15 team. They make the tournament every year. They usually play to the second weekend.
Geez, even Xavier in Cincinnati, they have to have comparable recruiting budgets. And Xavier has been out-recruiting them for, like, years.
Yeah.
And, like, looking through, like, the top recruits that, like, was brought in, just for whatever reason or another, just haven't worked. Like, Jermaine Lawrence had more problems than basketball. But he was, like, the last big-time recruit they brought in, and he definitely did not work out, to say the least. I don't even think he's playing college basketball. I don't think he's playing anymore.
No, I think he was booted from Manhattan.
The recruiting issue is, I think, is going to be a lot bigger in the coming years, because like the difference between the haves and have-nots in college basketball is starting to get pretty stark.
Yeah, it always has been, but mid-majority used to, the term the red line, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
The red line is going up and up. It used to be that there were maybe 80 programs above the red line. Now there's probably only like 40, maybe 50. And if that keeps going up the way it seems to be, at a certain point, UC is going to be below that line, and that's going to be a huge problem.
Yeah, I'm looking at the 2017 rankings right now on 24/7, and the only teams who aren't in power leagues, like Xavier is not I guess they are in a power league for basketball. Like Western Kentucky is ranked 15th, and UConn's 21st, MVCU's 25th. That's pretty much it. Like they're all up, the rest of them are all either Big East, ACC, SEC, Big Ten, and it seems like a lot of these lower, like the AAC is kind of a lower league. Let's just be honest, and like their budgets aren't as big. And like if the Big East, all their money goes to basketball. It's like you have another league, so you have six big time leagues to contend with, and it seems like they're just like sucking up more and more talent, especially as some of these places like Alabama and Auburn have like improved their coaching situations, and like now they're bringing in gigantic classes. It's kind of like a big like class issue in basketball now. I guess that's more of a discussion for another day.
Yeah, I don't think we can really afford to delve headfirst into that 125 minutes into this pod.
We did kind of try.
I mean, we took a big baseball bat and we swung at it. I'm pretty sure it's still standing though.
So we ended the basketball discussion on what seemed like a dark note.
Hey, we are back on brand.
Yeah, like that positivity from last week. Get the hell out of here.
Yeah, we don't do that.
Do you have anything else to add before we wrap up the podcast this week?
Bye, y'all.